Our 230 docket. Welcome to Division 6 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. We have just one case set for argument on this docket. It is Sweeney versus LaFond. I believe counsel are all set up for that case. Each of you should have received a written set of guidelines on our oral argument procedures. Let me just ask at the outset if anybody has any questions about those.
No, Your Honor, but I do have one preliminary housekeeping question.
Sure.
Mr. Neuwirth and I spoke before you all came in, and this is a suppressed case, which we wanted to recognize before the court, although based upon recent developments in the case that's at issue, the Maxwell case, it has recently settled, and I believe as of yesterday has been dismissed. So our concerns regarding the suppression are no longer at issue, so we're fine with this proceeding in the ordinary course.
I appreciate that. As you know, our oral arguments are recorded. They go on the court's website. They'll be on there within 48 hours or so after our argument. So I appreciate that there's no more suppression order, but to the extent that there's anything that you're worried about, you might be a little discreet in your arguments in terms of presenting it to us, because it will go out on the website within about 48 hours or so.
That's fair, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Your Honor, I don't believe that the Maxwell case has actually been dismissed yet. I believe it has settled and that the dismissal papers are pending in front of the federal judge.
That's correct.
If I may ask counsel, we are in possession of a document, I believe, that counsel for Ms. Sweeney filed recently. I want to make sure that you both are okay with me asking questions about that document, because I do have some questions about it and how the resolution of that case and the statements made in the document may affect what we have to do here today. So I just want to let you know that questions about that are coming.
Your Honor, just for purposes of clarification, what we attached to that pleading were either public documents or part of an interpleader complaint that was recently filed in Denver District Court, which is not operating under suppression. I will say that there are some confidentiality components to the settlement agreement itself. So depending upon what the questions might be, there may be some concerns there. We certainly don't want to put ourselves in a position that we're violating anything that was provided to us confidentially.
I don't want to violate any confidentiality, but nonetheless, because that was filed with us, we didn't ask for it, you gave it to us. I think that I've got to ask some questions in order to clarify at least the way I'm thinking about this case.
Understood, Your Honor. And like I said, with respect to what was attached, we have no concerns about discussing that.
Okay. Okay.
May I respond to Bernard's point?
Please.
I had very limited involvement in preparation of the document, Judge Bernard, that you're referring to. My knowledge of that whole situation is quite limited. I believe that Ms. Osgood had more communications with regard to it. I may not be able to answer your questions.
All right. Perhaps the best way to proceed is this. I will, you know, it depends on what my colleagues want to do. We could start the clock and I could just ask you, or perhaps the best way is to have counsel, you know, I'll state what my interest is, and we can have counsel each supply information, written information, within 5 working days. If you're willing to do that, because I need to understand for me what some of the statements in there meant. Okay? Is that acceptable to you if I state my concerns and then within 5 days each of you supply a written statement to the court?
That'd be fine.
I'm okay with that, Judge. It's just that not knowing what your concerns are.
Do you want to start the clock or not?
Yeah, why don't we get the order?
Okay.
Let's go on and then okay. Whenever you want.
Okay,
just 2 other things before we start. Please, when you do come to the podium, identify yourself by name and registration number, just so we'll have that for the record. And then we do have some people in the audience, so I'd like to ask anybody who has a cell phone or a pager or anything like that, please turn it off now so as not to interrupt counsel or the court during argument. And unless there are any other questions or preliminary matters, let's go ahead and hear argument in LaFond versus Sweeney.
And so I'll hit you right out of the box. Just take some notes. I don't expect you, either side, to give me an answer now. I refer specifically to paragraphs 34, 35, and 36 in the complaint for interpleader that was provided to us. The questions I would like to have answered are these. It states Sweeney and LRNS have agreed that certain of those sums, these are the sums that result from the settlement, may be properly paid to LaFond or Sweeney, and that another certain amount remains in dispute. I think I need to understand what those terms mean. Specifically, I need to understand how this $801,000, which is stated in here, is that meant, did the parties agree that for this $801,000 that this is potentially money that would be entirely owed to Ms. Sweeney, money that should be split 50-50 between Mr. LaFond and Mr. Sweeney? Because obviously the agreement of the parties is going to be important here. And I noticed that the clock is not running.
And it should. Yeah, go ahead and speak.
Okay. So at any rate, if I could have an answer about that, because if theoretically the parties agreed that we will split 50-50, if the court tells us to, and that all of the money in this $801,000 would be the share that would go to Ms. Sweeney, i.e. the total figure was approximately $1.6 million. Or this figure is the entire figure that came Mr. LaFond's way, and it would be split if the court agrees with Ms. Sweeney in the middle, in other words, about $400,000 each. I don't know. And the certain sums may be properly paid to LaFond or Sweeney. I don't know if that includes costs that were advanced, actual time that was put in by either of the parties when the case was still with LaFond and Sweeney. So if I could have some clarification about that, I'd appreciate it, because I just want to understand what this pot of money means. Okay?
And Your Honor, as I understand it, we're going to provide some supplemental briefing or information with respect to that issue.
That could be done in a letter written to the three members of this panel within 5 working days, and I'd appreciate one from each side. And you know, if you can get together and provide one letter under both signatures, and thus there's no dispute over it, that would make our lives easier, because there apparently has been an agreement here. That's not going to happen. I understand it's not going to happen. I'm not trying to force anybody to do anything. I'm just hope that I can get some understanding. Does that work for you?
That works for me, and I likewise hope and expect that we could do that.
Okay. Mr. Newworth, is that okay with you?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, counsel. Sorry for being a pain in your necks.
Your Honor, I will say in short, and we'll get into some of this as my argument proceeds, but I can tell you without breaking down the specific sums that the amounts that are indicated in the interpleader complaint under our argument would be awarded solely to Ms. Sweeney, i.e. the 50% that Mr. LaFond would have had right and entitlement to as a co-equal member of LaFond and Sweeney, would already be paid out to him.
I understand that. Maybe I just want to be sure, and I want to make sure that Mr. Newworth agrees with that.
Understood, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right. So why don't we get the clock going? You can identify yourself.
Sure.
And give us your argument.
May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jennifer Osgood of Burns, Figa, and Will. My registration number is 35070. I represent the appellants in this matter, Charlotte Sweeney and LaFond and Sweeney, LLC. This case is really about whether a firm performed 96% of the work on a contingent fee matter should get none of the nearly $1.5 million contingent fee. As you've seen from the briefing in this matter, the facts, the relevant facts at least, are pretty simple. They're pretty straightforward. This is a dispute between two former law firm members, Ms. Sweeney and Mr. LaFond, formerly of LaFond and Sweeney, LLC. The only matter for purposes of this dispute
is the fees earned or to be earned in one particular case, which is the Maxwell case. LaFawn and Sweeney had represented Mr. Maxwell over a four-year period in a quitam case brought against Hermagee Oil and Gas Corporation, which is currently pending in the United States District Court for the District of Colorado. After LaFawn and Sweeney dissolved, which was effective June 1st of 2008, Mr. LaFawn continued in his representation of Mr. Maxwell as Richard C. LaFawn, PC. As the court is now aware, a settlement agreement has been reached in the Maxwell case and is anticipated to be dismissed any time now. Through trial in this matter, Mr. LaFawn argued that despite the extensive amount of work performed in the Maxwell case while it was at LaFawn and Sweeney, that the firm was not entitled to any portion of a future recovery. Over the objection of Mr. LaFawn, the trial court determined that a contingency fee case pending at the time of dissolution of a law firm is in fact an asset of the law firm. However, the trial court, beyond just making the determination of finding that it was an asset, but arbitrarily determined the value of the Maxwell case at the time of dissolution based solely on the time slips that had been kept by LaFawn and Sweeney. The trial court made this determination despite the fact that the Maxwell case was an active case still pending. And in our view, this was a premature decision and has ultimately resulted in a windfall to Mr. LaFawn.
I've had a question. Is the case the asset or is the fee the asset?
The fee is the asset. So the fees that LaFawn and Sweeney earned or would earn while the case was pending at LaFawn and Sweeney. LaFawn and Sweeney are the asset that's in dispute here. So the two issues that I'm sure the court is familiar with now, I think they're briefed as several in the briefs, but really can be boiled down to two things, which are whether the trial court failed to properly apply the law on the issue of valuation of pending contingency cases at the time of dissolution of a law firm, and whether the trial court prematurely attached a value to LaFawn and Sweeney's interest in fees earned or to be earned in the Maxwell case. With respect to these issues, there are actually several things that the parties do agree on. We agree, or rather Mr. LaFawn no longer contests as he did through trial, that the fees earned or to be earned are indeed an asset. We agree that this is a matter of first impression in Colorado and that there is no case law factually that is directly on point. We agree that other jurisdictions addressing this very same issue have adopted one of two approaches. In our briefs, we have coined those approaches the contract and approach and the quantum merit approach. What we disagree about is which approach should be adopted and how that approach should be applied. We argue that the contract approach, which is the approach adopted by the vast majority of jurisdiction, is what this court should adopt. While Mr. LaFawn argues that the court should adopt the quantum merit approach, which to my knowledge has only been adopted by one other jurisdiction. But bottom line is, regardless of which approach this court determines is the appropriate approach to be applied, the trial court did neither. Under the contract approach, the basic underlying principle is that the firm's dissolution does not terminate the firm's contractual relationship with its clients. It treats a lawyer's responsibility to continue on with a pending contingent fee case as part of the duties and responsibilities in winding up the affairs of the firm. Once the fees are received, those fees are a firm asset, and then those fees are to be distributed according to whatever the attorney's interests were prior to the time of dissolution. Although the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the trial court cites to a number of cases applying the contract approach, the court did not in fact apply the contract approach. Mr. LaFawn argues that the contract approach is bad policy in that it would impair a client's right to choose his or her counsel. And while we agree that the primary consideration should be the client and the client interest, application of the contract approach has no impairment as to a client's rights and ability to choose his or her counsel. In fact, part of the approach is actually to avoid putting the client in the middle of the dispute and to avoid the attorneys of the dissolving law firm from vying for what could be a potentially lucrative client.
So as I understand it, part of what you're arguing under the contract approach is that the lawyer who continues with the case, here was Mr. LaFon, has not only has a duty to the client, but a duty to the just dissolved firm to finish up the work.
And that is our argument. And
okay, so I want to go on from it. What if the client says, I want to keep you on, Mr. Lawyer, because you've been the person who's been handling this. But I don't, you know, that contingency fee agreement that we had that was at 40%, I don't like that. I want you to do it at 25%. And the lawyer says, sure, I'll be happy to do that. Where are we then?
Well, I think that attorney still has to address what his or her fiduciary duties are to the firm, because that contingent fee agreement under the contract approach still belongs to the firm. The contract does not terminate. So I think there are mechanisms through agreement that you can resolve that issue. I see that to be an issue with the holder of the contingent fee agreement, which at that point in time is in fact the firm. I think that type of a scenario arises, but it doesn't change what the attorney who's going to continue on in the representation, what his or her fiduciary duties are, particularly in the light of a limited liability company, where under the Colorado Limited Liability Company Act, there are express provisions within the act that says, even though we've dissolved the entity, it's going to continue in order to wind up the affairs. And you don't just have fiduciary duties while the entity is a viable ongoing concern. You have specific enumerated duties in winding up the affairs. And part of that is to account for fees back to the firm. So I think, you know, there are client issues and client concerns that can be resolved, but that's competing with what this attorney's fiduciary duties are in the terms of the limited liability company. You know, these two attorneys entered into this firm voluntarily. They decided to form a limited liability company. They could have made a decision to alter or change what their rights were under the limited liability company act through an operating agreement. In this particular case, they chose not to do so, which means, yes, there's fiduciary duties. And those fiduciary duties include accounting to the firm in the winding up of firm business, which included, in this case, the Maxwell case.
Do you agree under that scenario that you are impairing that client's ability to negotiate a contingency fee for the 25%?
I don't think there's an impairment here. I can say, without getting into specifics, and this is an area of concern now that I have about what occurred in this case, and so I want to be cautious in not getting into the particulars. I can say that issue was at issue here and was successfully resolved, I believe, to the client's satisfaction. So to the extent it becomes an issue, I think there's ways to resolve it. And I think there's ways to resolve it without impairing what a members' continuing fiduciary duties are to the limited liability company. Because it happened here, so.
Okay, Ms. Oscar.
Sure.
If I may take you another step down the road, let's say for purposes of discussion that we agree with you that the contract approach is generally the way to go. However, we know that Mr. LaFon did additional work after he left the firm.
Mm-hmm.
That work has value. How is he compensated for that?
Potentially through quantum merit. I mean, the cases in other jurisdictions take a variety of approaches. A lot of those jurisdictions take a very hard line approach, which is it is a firm asset. And to the extent that a partner or, and in most of these cases, I will say that they were dealing under the Uniform Partnership Act, which we're not dealing with here. But the partner has a duty to wind up the business, and his interest in whatever he did post-dissolution is going to be based upon his partnership interest prior to dissolution. We're not taking such a hardline approach here. I mean, we've annotated in the brief to the fact that under the Colorado Limited Liability Company Act, there's no preclusion from a member who takes steps to wind up business, that they shouldn't be compensated. So arguably, they should be compensated here. And to the extent that they should be compensated, my position would be that the contract, the contingent fee contract, goes to the dissolving law firm, and arguably, Mr. LaFawn would then be entitled to a quantum merit value based upon the continuing services that he provided post-dissolution. Does that...
In addition to his 50% of the contingency fee?
Of course. Of course. So Mr. LaFawn contends that despite the fact that the court only cites two cases in its findings of fact and conclusion of law in favor of the contract approach, in reality what the court was doing was applying the quantum merit approach. However, there's absolutely nothing in the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law to suggest that this was what it was doing. First, I'd note that there's only one case cited to in the briefing done on this issue, where a jurisdiction has adopted the quantum merit approach. And to the extent that the trial court wanted to adopt the quantum merit approach, there is analogous Colorado case law that it could have and should have been relied on, primarily being LaSavio Jr. versus law firm of Michael W. McDivitt. LaSavio identifies several factors, which are also enumerated within the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct, for the court to consider in determining a quantum merit value. I mean, the laundry list is long and many, but it's very clear from the trial court's order in this case that no consideration was given to any of these factors. No consideration was given to the fact that this contingent fee agreement had two component parts, one in the event that statutory fees were awarded, and then a percentage contingent fee. It's not addressed within the court's order. There's no consideration given to the fact that LaFawn recorded more than 1,600 hours pre-dissolution and only 68 hours post-dissolution. There's no consideration to the fact that LaFawn and Sweeney advanced costs greater than $60,000 pre-dissolution, and Mr. LaFawn advanced no costs post-dissolution. There's no accounting for the fact that while the case was at LaFawn and Sweeney, that there was a $7.5 million verdict. There's no consideration for the fact of the substantial amount of risk that LaFawn and Sweeney took on in order to handle this case. And the reason that the court maybe didn't consider these things was because the Maxwell case wasn't over. I mean, it was still pending at the time. And as the court pointed out, the fact of the matter is Mr. LaFawn was still counsel of record and the case was ongoing, so it was probably not the appropriate time to be making these types of determination. And it was for this reason that we had suggested to the court at the time that it make a specific finding based upon our declaratory judgment claim that the fees earned were an asset but reserved jurisdiction. And we understand that it was at the court's discretion whether or not to reserve jurisdiction or not, but the alternative was not to just arbitrarily pick a value. The alternative was for the trial court to say, yes, it's an asset. I can't determine the value presently. Come back when you have a final judgment or some final adjudication, which, by the way, as of a day or two from now, we will likely have. The windfall has not, to Mr. LaFawn, is not really apparent until we get to settlement here. The trial court's valuation of the Maxwell case was about $600,000 based upon the time slips that LaFawn and Sweeney had recorded as of the date of dissolution. Mr. LaFawn ultimately submitted more than $700,000 worth of LaFawn and Sweeney time, not his own time, LaFawn and Sweeney time, that was then awarded to the court. In addition to the statutory fee, absent intervention from this court, Mr. LaFawn will also be awarded approximately $1.5 million in a contingent fee, which we argue is an unintended and absurd result, which is why we're seeking remand to the trial court, hopefully with the contract approach for additional findings of fact, in order to determine what the proper valuation is.
Thank you, Ms. Osgood, your time is up.
Yes.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Dean North, 17181, representing Mr. LaFawn. If this panel adopts the Uniform Partnership Act or contract model, it will violate Colorado Supreme Court precedent in Olson v. Brown, 1995 case. That precedent must be followed. It's a case we discussed in our answer brief. It's not even cited in the reply brief. And Ms. Oskett said that Mr. LaFawn agrees that this fee is an asset. We do not agree it's an asset. And the reason is because of the analysis in the Olson and Brown case. Olson and Brown says, as a matter of public policy in the state of Colorado, that a client can leave a firm at any time without cause. And therefore, this is the key point, the firm cannot rely on the indefinite continuation of employment under a fee agreement with a client. What that means is if the client leaves, this is what Olson and Brown held, the firm's payment is limited to the reasonable value or quantum merit value of the work. Now, Olson and Brown was an hourly case, but it discussed Rudinsky, an earlier case, which was a contingency fee case, said same principle applies there. We see no reason to differentiate between the two types of cases. That's the law in Colorado. What that tells you is that if a client decides to leave a firm, that client deprives the firm of the contingency fee. And what's important to relate Olson and Brown to the Wellman v. Parker case out of Missouri is that when a law firm dissolves and you have a pending contingency fee case, the client has a choice. It's really threefold. Presuming that the old firm broke up into two firms, as happened here, the client can go with either firm, or the client can go with a totally new and unrelated firm. One thing the client can do, and this gets to your question, Judge Loeb, about maybe the client having the ability to renegotiate his or her original deal, the client under Olson and Brown and Ethics Opinion 116 in Colorado has a right to say to the dissolved firm and all the attorneys in it, a pox on all of your houses, I am going to go to a totally new firm. Okay? Under their approach, that cannot happen. And that violates Olson and Brown, and it violates the public policy of the state of Colorado. It has to happen. It has to be allowed to happen.
Pardon me, Mr. Neuwirth, why can't it happen? For example, the firm breaks up. The client doesn't like the result. The client tells both lawyers, sorry, I'm going somewhere else. Now, that's why I asked the question about what's the asset. The case is surely the client's case. But if the asset is the fee and the client fires the firm, well, that's a different issue, isn't it?
No, Your Honor, they're indivisible. If you read Olson and Brown and Wellman and you follow the logic, the case is the fee. The fee comes from the case. And Ms. Osgood said that it belongs to LaFawn and Sweeney. It doesn't. What Ethics Opinion 116 says, what Olson and Brown says, what Wellman and Parker say, Wellman v. Parker says, is the case and the fee from it do not belong to any lawyer. There's no property interest in this. The whole Uniform Partnership Act analysis, this contract analysis, is based on property law and the idea that if you are party to a contract, the law firm is party to a contract with a client, the law firm has a contractual expectation to a certain fee here, a future contingency fee. That's a property right. So it belongs to me. That property right belongs to me, the dissolved firm. If my firm dissolves, sure, it doesn't terminate the contract with the client from my side, but the client still has the ability to terminate the contract from his side. What Olson and Brown says is the client can do that anytime for any reason. Once the client does, he's gone. And so is that contingency fee. And that means that the law firm has no right of expectation to a future contingency fee. It says it right in the opinion. If you have a Uniform Partnership Act model, like you're saying, that can happen. Now we're contravening the Olson and Brown case.
Let me ask a hypothetical. I understand it wasn't the case here, but let me ask a hypothetical. Assume that this was all done on an hourly. Firm breaks up. The case gets resolved. The hypothetical Mr. LaFawn gets paid based upon his 1,700, 1,800, 2,000 hours, whatever. Are you saying that the firm had no interest in any of that money?
Are you talking about money that Mr. LaFawn earns after the dissolution?
No, before the dissolution.
So you're saying it was hourly work that was...
I assume 1,500 hours before the breakup, 500 hours afterwards.
But it hadn't been paid.
Hadn't been paid.
Okay. The firm does have an interest in it, and that's the Olson and Brown case, the hypo you just gave me. And what Olson and Brown says is that all that firm gets is the reasonable value, the quantum merit value of its work. That's it. And that's my point. And the Olson and Brown case also says we're not going to treat contingency cases any differently from non-contingency for this purpose. So all I'm here to say is when you apply Olson and Brown to our setting, what you get is all the dissolved firm here, LaFond and Sweeney, gets is the quantum merit value of its work. And that's exactly what Roman v. Parker does in this exact type of dissolution setting.
Olson, a case where the client went to a brand new firm, or like this case, went to one of the former partners in the old firm?
There was no dissolution in Olson and Brown, Your Honor, and the opinion does not say where the client went. What happened in Olson and Brown was this, and it's a harsh case to the lawyers, to the old firm, rather, not the dissolved firm. There was a firm, and it had a contract with the city of Englewood to do hourly work on some huge toxic tort litigation. And it, one of the conditions of the agreement was that this was the only case that that firm could work on. And that firm went out and it hired other lawyers to help it. And then Englewood comes in and says to the Olson and Brown firm, you're fired without cause. There was no cause. So Olson and Brown sues for its fee. And the Supreme Court said, you don't get anything except the quantum merit value of the work that you did up till the time that you were fired. And the reason is the client can breach unilaterally a fee agreement and fire you without cause and go elsewhere. And as soon as that happens, your expectation to payment for future work is gone.
But then what, if those are the facts, why is that, as you say, dispositive of our case, where you have no dissolution in that case, and you don't have a situation where, after dissolution, one of the partners of the now-dissolved firm gets the case and the other one doesn't? I mean, isn't our case limited to those facts, and can't our holding, however it comes out, be limited to the circumstances we have here? I don't see how Olson, as you've described, certainly is relevant. It has some bearing on the balancing of a client's interests and the fiduciary duty, if there is one, of a ex-partner. But I don't see how it's dispositive of our case.
It is dispositive because look, I agree. Olson and Brown is not a dissolution case, and that's why I'm pushing the Wellman v. Parker case, because if you read Wellman v. Parker carefully, you see that the exact same principles from Olson and Brown here in Colorado are the underpinnings of the ruling in Wellman v. Parker, and Wellman v. Parker is a dissolution case, and it explains why you go from step A, which is Olson and Brown, to step B, which is the dissolution in Wellman v. Parker. And the reason is that as a matter of public policy, if you support the proposition that a future fee to a firm, whether it's dissolved or not, that future fee is an asset of that firm in any respect, in any amount, other than quantum merit, then what you've done is you've violated the client's ability, the client's right to choose his lawyer. And this goes back to Judge Lichtenstein's question about the hypothetical, Judge Loeb, that you spun and asked Ms. Osgood about, the client's right to try and renegotiate. And I'm trying to make a similar point with respect to the client's ability to go to a wholly new law firm. So if you adopt the model that Ms. Sweeney wants you to adopt, what happens in this situation, dissolution situation, is a client, if he wants to have a lawyer who's truly incentivized, properly incentivized under a contingent fee agreement to work his case to a successful conclusion, he can go to a wholly new third-party firm. He can do that under existing Colorado cases. But if you adopt a position that they want you to adopt, he couldn't stay with his current lawyer and incentivize his current lawyer the same way. And that impermissibly chews his right to counsel, his ability to counsel of his choice. And that's discussed in the Wellman v. Parker decision. There's some language on page 457 of the case that says that the trial court's limited view of limited compensation available to the withdrawing partner would unduly impinge the client's freedom to change attorneys without cause and would have a chilling effect on the choice of that option by the client if the client chose to have the withdrawing partner continue to represent him. So you would be creating an unequal situation where the client would be in this Hobbesian choice of, if he wants a properly incentivized contingent fee lawyer, he has to go start over brand new with somebody else who knows nothing about the case. Or he can stay with the lawyer who's been his lawyer for a number of years, knows all about the case, but that lawyer is now not properly incentivized. He's hobbled because he's tied at the hip to the dissolved law firm.
Mr. North, of all the cases that have touched on this issue, why is Missouri the only one that goes your way? Well, what's wrong with the others?
Missouri, I'm glad you asked that question, Mr. North. Missouri is the most recent case. And I found it very interesting that you've got this body, there's 8 or 10 states, maybe 12. So most states have not addressed this question at all, as far as I can tell. There's a cadre of roughly 10 that have. And it goes back a long way to this outmoded view under the 1914 Uniform Partnership Act that a client is a property of the law firm, that the lawyers know better. Well, that's not the current modern view. So what Wellman v. Parker does is it looks at this body of law and it says, you know what, this is all outmoded. It doesn't accord with the modern view that lawyers have a duty to their clients. Clients, it's the client's case, it's not the lawyer's case. That's what Olson Brown does in Colorado. It recognizes that principle. It just doesn't apply it to a dissolution setting. So, look, I'll be honest with you. When I first got involved in this case, I thought the way you did. I thought, geez, this Uniform Partnership Act didn't make sense. It's the way to go. The more I read Wellman and Parker, the more of a believer I became, you know, taking off my advocate's hat. It is absolutely right. And if you look at, there's this case, Huber v. Etkin, out of Pennsylvania Superior, that Ms. Sweeney cited in her reply brief, and it was a 2-to-1 split. It was in favor of the Uniform Partnership Act, but you know what they did? They withdrew the opinion and accepted it on rehearing. This is a horse race. I don't want to sit down until I feel comfortable that you understand just, although Wellman really kind of stands alone, if I'm going to qualify that, what an important and watershed decision it is in this area of the law, and just how outmoded and wrong this body of 10 or so other cases are. You cannot treat a client's case or the fee that comes from it as the property of a law firm. The premise of Ms. Sweeney's position is that she had an expectation to a contingency fee. Well, you know what Olson & Brown says? So what? You're not the client. You're just the lawyer. Your expectation doesn't matter. You have to follow that. Now, aside from Wellman and Parker, I did cite a case called Kelly v. Smith, which is in my brief, which is a 1993 Indiana Supreme Court case, and it's a very interesting case because although it arises in a situation where there was a partnership agreement, I mean, most of the time in these cases, there's no partnership agreement. That's why we get into this situation. But there's a partnership agreement, and the partnership agreement applies in some respects to the dispute, but not to others, but there was no partnership provision addressing who gets what for pending contingency fee cases. And the Indiana Supreme Court said, we're aware of this whole body of case law under the Uniform Partnership Act. We're not going to apply it here. And it goes through the same quantum merit analysis that is discussed in Wellman v. Parker. And the court adopts that there because it said, we're looking holistically at the partnership agreement, and what we think the partners were trying to do is make a clean break, and the quantum merit model is the better way to do that. So we're not going to use the Uniform Partnership Act model. And importantly, that case also says clients are not possessed by anyone. Their cases are not possessed by anybody. So I would ask you to look at that case and consider that case as well. And I truly believe that Wellman is a watershed decision that is going to be followed by other courts around the country, and I would ask you to look very, very hard at it and read it carefully, because it goes through the Uniform Partnership Act analysis and it shows why it doesn't work. One of the things it says is that the premise of the Uniform Partnership Act model is that the client cannot hire the withdrawing lawyer to replace the dissolved firm, and it says this premise is undercut by the requirement that when a firm dissolves, it's the client who makes an informed choice of the lawyer, whose lawyer is going to be going forward, and thus the decision whether the contingency fee agreement will remain with this dissolved firm is solely that of the client. It's the client's decision. If the client chooses to go with another firm, then so does the fee.
Thank you, Mr. Neuwirth. Your time is up. Thank you to both counsel for your very helpful arguments. Case will stand submitted. Opinion will issue in due course. I remind counsel about getting us that little letter in the next 5 days or so. This concludes our docket for the afternoon, and the bailiff may announce a recess.